Can you guys hear me? Perfect. Well, it's a tremendous honor to be here, especially after preaching. I didn't know if I'd be let to preach again. So thank you for coming. My text is going to be the book of Ruth. So if you'll stand with me for the reading of God's word, we're going to go and start. We're not going to read the whole book of Ruth. I thought about it, but then I thought better of it. We're going to start with chapter 2, starting verse 1. Going to verse 12. Book of Ruth, chapter 2, 1 through 12. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his young men who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servants who were in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and come to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, and get this, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Let's pray. Lord, I pray for our time here tonight. I pray for me that I would not speak foolishly or stutter over my words, but rather that I would speak clearly and that the Spirit would move. I pray that the Word would not return to us void, but rather that fruit would bear a hundredfold. Lord, you are good and you are our Redeemer. And so I ask for our eyes to be opened to that truth through seeing how Boaz is Ruth's kinsman Redeemer and how you are our ultimate Redeemer. Amen. I am really, really, really bad with girls. I don't know if you guys have noticed this. But as a reference point, just this afternoon, a good friend of mine, Ryan Spencer, and I were eating at lunch together, and he asked me, "What are you preaching on?" And I said, "I'm going to give dating lessons out of Ruth," and he bust out laughing and said, "I better not do that." So I have changed my whole sermon. No, I'm kidding. It was just a joke, but he really did say that. It hurt me a little. But I really don't understand girls, the things that they do, some of the things that they say. I mean, group bathroom visits, don't get that at all. Hair plastered on the side of shower walls, don't get that. Also, don't get life-altering addictions to chocolate. And perhaps that lack of understanding is why I'm still single, I do not know. But the biggest thing they do that I don't understand is that they love romance stories. I have no idea. The reason, whether it's Nicholas Sparks or Jane Austen or anything, I don't understand romance stories. Because I think most guys would agree that they are exactly the same every single time. Right? You have this down on her luck girl. She's got something wrong with her, and she needs a man. She could be ill, depressed, complicated, doesn't understand men at all, right? Something's wrong with her, and she needs a man. And then enter Prince Charming. He comes in the story. He's got everything right, except for one major flaw. Normally bad boy tendencies. He likes to hit things or lives at home with his mom, something like that. And then conflict into the story, that they kind of work out their problems, and then conflict into the story, and the conflict is almost always can be resolved with a simple conversation of, "I'm sorry, will you forgive me?" But the guy has to sit through this movie for 2 hours as like more and more drama and gossip happens, and you're just sitting there thinking, why does he not just say, I'm sorry? And she says, I'm sorry for being so sensitive. And then they just kiss and make up and everything's happy. But instead, you go through 2 hours and it ends always in the rain after an argument, a heated, passionate kiss. The woman's foot goes up like this. And the end of the movie, they live happily ever after, right? Guys, I just sometimes think, are you really buying this to the girl? I think that. Maybe that's, again, why I'm still single. But it's interesting that the story of Ruth, in my mind, is a romance story. You have a young widow born into the wrong nationality. You have a wealthy hero with a heart for Moabite missionary dating. And you have what everyone wants in a romance story, the bitter mother-in-law. And yet, besides being a knockdown ringer for any director to pick up as a chick flick, there's more going on in Ruth than just mere entertainment. Because within this earthly romance, there are flashes of a divine romance lighting up the darkened backdrop of Ruth's story. Her story, although not in the book of Judges, is set during the time of the Judges. And lest we forget where we are in the divine play of history, where God rescues his bride, humanity, from all sorts of evil, herself included, let me paint in broad strokes where we are. Because there's a presupposition I'm making here. The presupposition is that the character Boaz within the text, who's a kinsman redeemer to Ruth, is actually a reflection or a type, an example of the Redeemer, Christ. So, I have 3 points. I'll spell them out to you so we all know where I'm going. The first is that the Redeemer shelters the needy under his wings. Second is that the Redeemer longs for the needy to be in his family. And the third, the Redeemer promises undying love to the needy. And when we as a church and as individual Christians begin to hold on to these promises of the Redeemer, our hearts will be inspired to trust him and to love him. But let me go back to just giving some backdrop of Ruth really quickly. In the prologue of the Bible, God created all of humanity in peace and harmony. He breathed life and soul into mankind. He made him a helper, gave him land to cultivate and peace to keep. And then man and his woman rebelled against God and they ran from him. Yet even as they fled, this Creator breathed another life into mankind, for he whispers hope. And he says, one will come who will crush the head of the serpent. One will come who will end all evil. One will come who will restore our relationship back to what it should be. And the story progresses. Humanity falls into darkness. Is that really loud when I swallow? Because that's just really awkward. Humanity falls into darkness. Chaos, violence, and sexual morbidity infest the land. Characters born and die. Kingdoms rise and fall. Whispers of the Messiah are hinted at. And a remnant of people hold fast to the belief that one is coming who will crush the head of the serpent. And the author begins to weave a family into the fabric of history that eventually becomes a nation. And this nation is then covenanted with by God. And the covenant basically says, if you obey my commandments, I will protect you, Israel. If you do not obey my commandments, I will withdraw my protection from you and I will curse you. And the people agree to this. They say, yes, we want this protection. Yes, we're going to do this. And they set off to obtain a promised land. All they had to do was get this promised land, remove the people living there, and then obey God's commandments. And yet they don't. And like Adam and Eve before them, they are separating themselves from God. And it's in this time of darkness that we find Ruth and her people and the whole story. The people of Israel are in rebellion yet again, and God has left them. The people murder each other. Rape is rampant. Religion is so twisted that even idolatry seems holy. And so God sends a famine onto the land, devastating crops and livestock in an attempt to get his people's hearts back towards him. And it's in this time of darkness we find God yet again whispering hope to his people through the romance of Ruth and Boaz. Because the people are saying, is there a Messiah? And then God paints us this picture of romance. In the first chapter of Ruth, a man named Elimelech takes his family and leaves to get away from the famine, and they go to Moab. And his sons there marry Moabite women. But let's not forget, one does not simply marry Moabite women. These are women from a nation that God has told the people to remove from the land. These are women born out of Lot's incestuous relationship with his daughters. These are women who seduced the people of Israel into rebelling against God, and thousands were killed of it in the book of Numbers. Pastor Lee talked about this morning. One does not simply marry Moabite women. So it's no surprise that the three men of the family die shortly after this, leaving a bitter mother, Naomi, and two barren daughter-in-laws, Ruth and Orpah. Upon hearing the news that God had lifted the famine out of Israel, because the people start turning their hearts back towards God, and so God removes, just as He said He would do in the covenant, removes the famine in a loving, graceful way, then Naomi decides to go back to her people because she has nothing left in Moab for her. And then the two daughter-in-law start following after her. She's like, no, stay. I have no kinsman redeemer left for you. Now, kinsman redeemer is a male relative in the family who would have married a widow, right? So a woman, husband dies, and then the man says, okay, I am going to take care of you. I'm going to look after you. You're not going to be in need for the rest of your life because I'm going to marry you and love you. That's what a kinsman redeemer is. And she says, I have no male kinsman redeemer left. There's no one left for you to marry. And so Orpah decides to stay in Moab and remarry. But Ruth is a harder case. Ruth is an extraordinary woman. And it's here we see the first glimmer of hope from the least likely of sources, a Moabitess. A woman who by all accounts should be the one to run away from the promises of God is so far the only one in the story who clings desperately to them. Your people will be my people and your God my God, she says in verses 16 through 17 of chapter 1. And by saying these words, she is willingly handing herself over to be judged by the harsh stereotyping of the Israelites and the perfect and powerful judgment of Yahweh. She is willingly subjecting herself to ridicule from being a barren woman and a widow to being childless and husbandless for the rest of her life, all because she has a deep faith in God and a love for her mother-in-law. And yet Naomi, the mother-in-law, is still bitter. After completing the dangerous trek back to Israel, Naomi gets to town and she tells the women in verses 20 through 21, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, which means bitter. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full and the Lord has brought me back empty. You can hear the venom in her words. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and brought calamity against me? And isn't it interesting how when we're going through hard times, and hardships are all around us, it's precisely in those moments we cannot see any of the good that God does for us. It's as if we have blinders on our eyes. We can only see 2 feet in front of our face. All we can see is the hardship and the trial. And you just want to shake her and say, wake up, Naomi. Look around you. You went on a faithless move to another land, and yet God has brought you back with your life. You've lost your pride and possessions, but you still have Ruth, who's an oasis in the desert for this resentful and bitter woman. And you just want to say, you don't have much, but you have some. And even that some is given to you by God, blessing you in this life. That we want to be free from our pain, and yet there is something addicting with dwelling on it. And this is exactly what Naomi does when she gets back to Israel. In chapter 2, the two impoverished widows come to the town of Bethlehem and they try to make a living there, gleaning wheat in other people's fields. And it's here we see the hero of the story, Boaz. The story tells us now Naomi's husband had a relative named Boaz. And right then the reader should think, but wait, I thought Naomi had no male relative, right? Back in Moab, she was saying to Ruth and Orpah, I have no male relative, woe is me, I have all this trouble. And that is exactly what sin does to us, right? That with those blinders on, Naomi totally forgot she had this male relative. And even in the story, she doesn't know it yet. But the writer is sitting there making a point. Hey, there really is a male relative. The curtain pulls up and behold, Boaz. Music plays, the clouds part and angels sing. It's not as we had thought. There is a kinsman redeemer remaining in Elimelech's line. And Prince Charming walks on the set and begins blessing everyone. If you've ever seen Beauty and the Beast, one of my favorite Disney movies, it's like Belle walks on the scene in like the first like 2 seconds and she's like, bonjour, bonjour. And everyone's bonjour, bonjour, right? This is exactly what's happening in the text. The reader wants you to know that Boaz is loved by his people. And so Boaz walks around. He's being blessed by all his people. He's blessing people. These are his fields. He has tons of workers who love him and all these things. And then he stops when he sees a certain young woman who he hasn't seen before. And he says, whose young woman is this? And the men say, it's Ruth, the Moabitess. She's been taking care of Naomi for all this time. And she's been working hard all day. And notice Ruth's reputation precedes her. She and Boaz have not met yet, and yet her reputation precedes her. And we see nothing of Ruth's outward beauty here. Not once does the passage say anything about her being physically stunning, as it does many other women in the Bible. Rachel, Sarah, Esther, Bathsheba, Abigail. It's all, they're godly women and they're really, really amazingly attractive. But you don't see that with Ruth. What's remarked about is her heart. The writer is making a point that outward beauty here is pointless. What is it that makes Ruth so marvelous? What is it that catches everyone's attention and arrests their focus on her? It's her kindness and affection for Naomi. It's her unquenchable spirit. She's a foreigner, destitute, poor, needy, has nothing, and yet she's taking care of the destitute, the poor, and the needy, quietly, steadily. She's not seeking men's praise by doing this, right? It's other people who bring the news to the great, awesome Boaz, right, that this is going on. And that's what makes her beautiful. It's her sacrificial heart to do what's right, even when she has seemingly every reason not to. And let me say this, there is something deeply moving to a godly man when he sees godliness in his sisters, and Boaz sees it in Ruth. And yet, she has one flaw. She's a Moabite. She is the enemy of everything that Boaz or any good Jew would have stood for. She is cursed by her nationality and her ancestors. People would have whispered as she walked by that she was a barren woman, filthy, poor, a blight to the social order and the community. Her very presence would have been a stench to most people, yet not this man, Boaz. This man became intrigued by this outsider and this outcast. And it's here we see the first mark of the Redeemer. The Redeemer shelters the needy under his wings. Boaz sees Ruth and he tells her in verse 8, chapter 2, "Do not go glean in another field or leave this one." He sees her need and he rushes to fulfill it. Her first need is food. Her first need is protection, and he gives her both. He says that his protection is over her. Imagine in those days the fear that would grip a woman's heart as she finds herself alone in a field with a group of men. Rape and murder happen all the time in this stage in history, all the time. And so a woman being alone, being poor and needy with no man to protect her, was an incredibly dangerous place. And yet Boaz gives her full access to every one of his fields, orders his men to protect her in those fields, gives her more portions than she needs, and even offers her water and shade when she's in need of rest. In essence, he's telling Ruth, "Do not fear when you're with me." This is the resounding word of the Redeemer to those under his mighty and sheltering wings. And notice Ruth's reaction to this protection in verse 10. She falls down on her face and she asks, "Why? Why would he do this for me? Does he not know who I am? Does he not know where I've come from?" And her humility is striking. But Boaz's response is perfect, for he cares nothing of where she's been or what she's done. He basically tells her in verse 12, this is key, that because she has taken refuge under the wings of the God of Israel, he would rescue her and give her refuge under his wings. Much like another Redeemer we know, yes? So as the day goes on, Boaz begins his pursuit of Ruth. He asks her over to his place for lunch, and the first date in the Bible is recorded over granola and alcohol. Now imagine her shock as she comes into the fields, right? Just that morning, she's come into the fields to glean scraps off the dirty ground, poor and destitute, and by noon, by lunchtime, she's dining with the Lord of the harvest at his very own table, drinking his wine and speaking to him as a friend. The place that she's in, underneath the sheltering wings of the Redeemer, is an incredible place to be. I ask you this, Cornerstone. Does not Christ do this for you? And while I do that, I will find my place because I'm lost. Go back to that sheet later. It's here in the story that Boaz, or that the writer is forcing the reader to consider that maybe, just maybe, Ruth and Boaz will fall in love. Ruth has to go back to the fields, leaving a very thoughtful Boaz to his planning. And you can tell by the language that Boaz is using that he is beginning to fall for Ruth. He's saying and doing just enough to hint at a stirring affections. And this is usually how older guys pursue ladies, not that I would know. Boys will try for feats of strength or charm to attract women, regardless, trying to get some kind of benefit. But from what I've seen, mature men will just take care of woman, regardless of the benefit they get, quietly, intentionally, seeking out her needs, and when they see it, they rush to fulfill it. And Boaz is doing this in the text. He tells his men to give her more portions of grain than she needs. By the end of the day, she collects 30 to 50 pounds of grain. Most in the field could only hope for 1 or 2 pounds. And yet she collects 20 times that by the mere word of Boaz. He has found favor. Or she has found favor of him. He owns all the fields. He owns all the workers. With but a word, he's able to give Ruth everything that she needs and more. And this is what it means to be under the Redeemer's wings. He is watchful and abounding in generosity to those in distress. And he cares for the needy. So she heads home. After getting all that grain, she heads home and having a great day with Boaz. And let me say that Ruth is a testimony to strong women, because she is lugging around 30 to 50 pounds on her back for miles to go back home, right? I don't even know how she did that. I don't think I could do that. And so she gets home. Naomi busts out the door when she sees Ruth carrying all this grain, and she doesn't really ask, like, can I help you? She's just so, like, shocked by all this. And she says in verse 19, where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the name of the man who took notice of you. And then Ruth tells her all about this older guy named Boaz. And Naomi hits the roof when she hears that name, because she had forgotten who Boaz is, and now she remembers. And she says, may he be blessed by the Lord. Get this, remember her bitterness. By the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. The once bitter and wandering widow is suddenly filled with joy when she realizes that God has meant well for her all along. It is a remarkable transformation that she makes. And don't we see this in ourselves? We are able to fight fear and anxiety and sin so easily when all of a sudden we realize that God means well for us. All of a sudden that stuff doesn't matter at all. All of a sudden we don't want that stuff because we trust that God means well for us. And we see Ruth's bitterness suddenly melting away to joy. Skipped another paragraph. So Naomi has Ruth tell her everything about what happened that day with Boaz. And with her elderly wisdom, Naomi picks up that Boaz is more than just a little interested in Ruth. And so she begins to concoct a somewhat scandalous plan. A few weeks or months go by, and Ruth and Boaz keep getting to know each other. It's in this time, if this was in a movie, you would have like a montage of happy like scenes. Like Boaz would be like just see, oh hey guys, you see her, I'm going to go check her out. Right? And they go talk, and then all of a sudden, you might see them like walking next to each other, and then Boaz will like throw rice in her hair, and she'll throw rice in his hair. They'll carry a balloon, play frisbee, a puppy will walk by. And so this goes on. At least you can tell my thoughts of romance movies. Naomi strategically finds out that Boaz will be threshing wheat until late into the evening, where he'll take his rest. And then Naomi tells Ruth, go make yourself look good. Go, I don't know, get beautiful, wash up, get fresh, put on some makeup, and wait till Boaz has taken some wine. There's a lot of alcoholic references here, I don't know. And after he takes wine and he starts to fall asleep, I want you to sneak into the threshing floor and jump under the covers with him. And the reader has begun, I think, if you're like me, you're just like, what the heck is going on here? This is a Bible story. But I think the writer is doing something. I think what he's doing here is he's making you begin to wonder some things. He's putting you in a place where you're like, okay. What she's suggesting is kind of scandalous, but I know Ruth's character so far in the story. And I know Boaz is a man of honor that constantly in the story so far, and we'll see in the future, always does what is better for others rather than himself. And so you're not supposed to think, okay, this is something scandalous that's about to happen. You're supposed to think, what's going to happen here? I don't know. Because I know it's not going to be that thing, but it's going to be something interesting. And so Ruth goes in, and in my mind's eye, she goes in like, and this is maybe because I like action movies, but she goes in like James Bond, like kind of like sneaking past guards, her back to the wall, barrel rolling, army crawling, knocking out a guard. And she goes in and like sneaks under the covers with him. By his feet, I need to say that. And then she probably had to wait there for some time. Could be hours as she waits there by his feet, waiting for him to wake up. And her mind probably stirred with questions. Trouble the hearts of women everywhere. What if he rejects me? What if I offend him lying next to him like this? What if he could never love a woman like me with the kind of past that I have? Or if he rejects me, what does that say about me? Is there something wrong with me? And for hours she could have been laying there dwelling on those insecurities, her heart pounding in her chest, wondering if she was good enough for a man of honor like Boaz, wondering if he had picked up on her affections for him at all. And then with a start, the man wakes up and he asks the reasonable question, who's there? Because someone has been in bed with him. So he asks, who's there? And Ruth whispers the words that she no doubt must have been rehearsing all night. I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. In other words, she's saying in chapter 3, verse 9, I am Ruth and I want to be your wife. Time is suspended as we wait to see if his affections are the same as hers. Heartbeats race as Ruth and Boaz start to see each other for the first time with new eyes. Everything is on the table, and rejection, embarrassment, and confusion could surely ensue. And there, with perfect timing, comes the Redeemer's response. Which brings me to my second point. The Redeemer seeks the needy as his family. In a moment of heightened stillness and apprehension, Boaz answers Ruth's hovering request. For he says in verse 10, you have made this last kindness greater than the first, and that you have not gone after younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, do not fear. I will do all that you ask. He tells her all her requests will be granted. He tells her there has been no need for fear. He has watched over her since the first day. He has set eyes on her, and his heart has beat faster as he thought of her. His affection was set on this Moabitess who in every national regard was his enemy. And his soul soars as he thinks that this diamond in the rough could actually look at him instead of the younger, richer men. Boaz is in love. The Redeemer agrees to make all of Ruth's wishes come true. He wants her to be his wife. He wants her to be in his family. And he's willing to go the lengths that it takes to get her there. But there is a problem. Enter the Rising Actions conflict. Suddenly, there is another Redeemer whose place that it's been all along for Boaz redeem Ruth. And that's what we find out in the story. That's basically why Boaz has kind of been on the back burner, right? Kind of waiting. And now he sees that not only is there a need, but there's also a want. He's going to rush and fulfill this need in Ruth's heart as a redeemer. But the problem is that this guy under God's law has got the first kind of the first step on Boaz. And so he's kind of, what am I going to do? He has to trust that God will do what's best. And so he does. And then that morning, he doesn't try to go and do his own thing. He goes and musters 10 elders. Everyone needed to make a legal declaration of marriage in Bethlehem, I guess, at that time. And then he waits for this mystery kinsman redeemer to show up. And the mystery kinsman redeemer shows up, and Boaz faithfully tells this guy all about Ruth. And it's this point in the story that you kind of want to punch Boaz in the face for being so righteous. You're like, come on, man, just take the girl and run. Get out of here. Go. You got everything you want. But Boaz doesn't do that. He considers this guy, who he doesn't even know hardly, as better than himself, which is interesting. But then, through the response of this mystery kinsman redeemer, we see what everyone else would do to a woman like Ruth, to the Moabitess that nobody wants. The mystery kinsman redeemer rejects her. He disregards her as being useless to his family. What righteous Israelite could ever want a woman like that? Who would ever take her as his beloved? The Redeemer could. And what seems for a second as a time of shame and disappointment for Ruth as she's being rejected becomes a time of sudden joy and acceptance as the Redeemer turns everything around. The reason for her shame becomes the reason for her boasting. Again, gospel parallel. We see Boaz completing the third characteristic of the Redeemer, and that is that the Redeemer promises the needy his undying love. Immediately after the agreement between the two men is made that Boaz is going to marry Ruth, we see these beautiful and powerful words in chapter 4, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And this is what we've been waiting for. Marriage is the promise of affection and love everlasting. It's the commitment that burns with an eternal flame. And Boaz makes this promise of affection and undying love to Ruth. But I ask you this, Cornerstone. Does not Christ do this for you? Has He not sheltered you under His wings? I want your hearts to be filled with overflowing as you trust God. You see, Boaz is only an example or a type of Christ. Does not God wish for you to be in His family? Has He not given generously life and freedom to all men who believe in His truth? Has He not taken liars and cheats and murderers, homosexuals, adulterers, pornographers, gluttons, drug abusers, murderers, and many more, and made them all a family of free men and women who are not bound to the sensualities of this world? A family of free men that sit together in this room and will one day sit together eating the marriage feast of the Lamb. He has adopted us. Is it not also true that He promises us undying love? Does His Word not proclaim this? Throughout all of history, the same being who breathed a whisper of hope to a fleeing couple in the Garden of Eden is the same God that whispers to you in your struggles and failures. The same God that upheld a wooden ark above flooding waters is the same God that promised to uphold you all of your days. The same God that thundered from a lonely mountain rages like a tempest to bring peace to His people, and the same Redeemer who woos His widowed bride is the same Redeemer who promises you undying love. Yet some could say, how can you say God promises undying love when He doesn't even lift a finger in this life to do it? How can you say God promises undying love? How can we trust Him in the future if He doesn't do it now? Two observations from the text. First off, God's undying love is in part shown in this life. Just look at Ruth. She's blessed tremendously in her life. Remember where she came from. A born enemy of God. A widow, wanderer, poor and destitute. And yet God gave her Naomi. Gave her adoption into His family. Gave her the affections of the Redeemer Boaz. Christian, you know when you're blessed by Him. And I challenge you to take off the blinders off your eyes and remember that God means well for you. Don't be like Naomi in the first half of the book, who could only see just the hardships in front of her. Be like Naomi in the last half of the book, whose bitterness melted away when she knew that God meant well for her. So, my second point, and how can I say that God promises undying love? The first is that He does indeed bless us in this life. The second is that God's undying love is more evidently shown in the blessings we know and hope for in the future. It's so easy to read Ruth and teach it as a message to ladies. You just need to wait on your Boaz because God knows how to give good gifts to His children. You just need to let go and let God, Jesus, take the wheel. Thank God the story of Ruth and Boaz is not so impoverished and pathetic as that. As if the apex of a woman's life is a man. Listen, a man is not your Boaz. A career, a summer job, a mission opportunity, a dream home, a child, graduate school, the applause of men, or any other thing is not your Redeemer. We think that if we can just obtain some dream, some lack in our hearts will be set. If I just get married, my discontentment will end. If I just get through this trial, suddenly my hardships will vanish forever. Yet there is more going on in the story of Ruth than her earthly desires being met. You see, we're given a name, a list of names at the end of the book that shout out to us the writer's intent. The purpose of Ruth and of this list of King David's genealogy at the end of the book is to show us that God will fulfill His promises to humanity, even though humanity is completely undeserving of His love. Remember in the beginning He said, one would come to crush evil. He has not forgotten that promise. What we quickly forget about in the moment of distress, God will never forget about because He envisions the grander picture. What is more, he's going to accomplish a part, a single small part of this redemption through the scandalous love of Ruth, the born enemy of God, and Boaz, the Redeemer. If you are like me, and you hurt, and you long for there to be something more in this life for you, you wonder if God really does love you when he lets you suffer, let this be crystal clear. This life is nothing compared to the light of eternity. You wait and wait, feeling disgruntled and bitter like Naomi when life seems to shatter like glass before you. There is but one true Redeemer, and he is the pearl of greatest price. Boaz is an earthly type of a greater reality found in Jesus. I cannot promise you your earthly desires will be met. I cannot promise you love, fame, prestige, success, power, or even peace in this life. But what I can promise you is that Christ will do as he said he will do. He will rescue mankind from the clutches of death and bring us to glory on wings of the morning. From his promise in the Garden of Eden that one will come who will crush the head of the serpent, to the kinsman redeemer's affection for Ruth, to Jesus Christ's defeat of sin and death on the cross and the redemption of his people, we would be fools to miss his undying love on us. The story of the beautiful romance of Ruth and Boaz ends by turning the reader's eye to the truth that just as Boaz was Ruth's kinsman redeemer, so the son of David, Jesus, is our kinsman redeemer. Ruth stands tall as a beacon of light, proclaiming safety and rest to all who remember that the Redeemer shelters the needy under his wings. The Redeemer longs for the needy to be in his family, and the Redeemer promises the needy undying love. Do not be one who sees so nearsighted that you miss the majestic romance story that is playing out before your eyes. Also, trust that God will do what is good for you. Meditate on the truth that God is earnestly seeking out your good. He's earnestly seeking out blessings that are greater than you can even imagine. See what he has done for our siblings in the faith, Ruth and Boaz, and in faith, trust him. He is your Redeemer. Let's pray and then you'll be dismissed. Father, you are good and you are kind to us. We thank you for rescuing us. We thank you for stories of love. Show us what you're doing in the spiritual realm. What you're doing in a way that is so much more powerful than we can ever even imagine. Lord, I thank you for being a God who pursues us though we wander. Though we even, not only do we do bad things, but even our ancestors, Lord, have blighted us to you. And yet you have made a way through the death of your Son to make a way that we can come before you again. So we thank you for that. We thank you for the gospel. We thank you for rising on the third day and destroying death and its hold on us. Lord, we thank you for this family. Help us to trust you. Help us to be inspired to live lives worthy of you. We love you. Amen. You're dismissed.